Welcome to the Theater of Others podcast. My name is Adam Marple, and I'm the co-artistic director of the Theater of Others. With the COVID-19 pandemic forcing a shutdown and reevaluation of space and gathering, we at the Theater of Others are thinking about what stories we need and how best we can share them. We believe space is psychology, and it informs the way in which an audience interacts and reacts to what is presented to them. We create uniquely theatrical events in bespoke sensory performance spaces crafted to encourage curiosity and grant the audience permission to commune with the play. Now that that space has moved online, how can we encourage interaction and action amongst an audience virtually? The Theater Brothers produces plays that both welcome and challenge the audience. We are committed to international collaboration and are a laboratory that helps artists grow through intensive study of their craft. On the podcast today, joining from Melbourne, Australia, are Booty Miller, co-artistic director of the Theater of Others, and myself in Puebla, Mexico. The Theater of Others creates a shared community of artists and audiences for the purpose of exploring the most profound issues of our lives and times. We believe the play watches the audience. The audience is necessary, and they are witness to what happens. And you get to be witness to us making that happen. The purpose of this podcast is to open up our process and let you in. We're peeling back the curtain, so to speak, and encouraging you to follow along, to ponder, prod, and question, to join us and criticize us if need be. Being a witness is no passive task, and it requires much from you. Are you up for the journey?
Hey, Adam.
Hi, Booty.
How you doing?
Oh, man. I'm buzzing, I'm excited, I'm tired from all the performance that we've had this weekend of the show.
Don't even talk to me about tired. Lord help me. No, but it's been really good.
It's been a big release. It's been a big release. We started working on this in April, May of 2020.
And then we had a false open.
Yeah. And we had 7 or 8 rewrites and actors moving all over the world. And oh, man.
It's insane. But that's the thing. It's like, I think this is how you make theater, right?
I can't even remember if this is how you make theater anymore.
Well, look, I think it's how you make theater when you're like living in what, how many different continents? 1, 2, 3 different continents, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
And you're attempting to perform at the same time together.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't want to put any value on what you've learned because there's already been a lot of learning. What are some of the great things that you learned in this process that you would like to offer to those who are considering doing the same thing?
Well, I think we talked a little bit about it in our virtual space episode that the idea of theater has to completely change. You can't treat it like it is theater. That suspension of disbelief is gone. A sense of a character, a believable character isn't there, but the idea of the actor being the character is gone, but the idea of a character can still exist. That you have to absolutely still recognize the audience just because you cannot see them anymore, because there is no literal presence of the audience, you cannot deny their existence because that will immediately turn the audience off. Mm. You have to engage with the audience. You have to acknowledge their existence. You have to remind them that they're there. This is live. They can be seen. They can be heard. They can participate. Otherwise, you know, I can open up another tab on my computer and do something else. I'm reminded of something that I very early on in the pandemic, City Company, which is the company that Anne Bogart and her ensemble of actors and performance makers created, they did these kind of, they called them city socials, where they basically just wanted to kind of like get together with the community of people who trained with City and just like check in and say, how are you doing? And just kind of talk for an hour. And this was, this was maybe in May or June. It was very early on in the pandemic. And I just found a quote from them that reminded me of this. And they said, you know, think about you're a painter. You have trained your entire life to be a painter. And then all of a sudden, photography comes along. Do you give up painting?
Oh,
or do you
cool.
adapt? Or do you do what only painting can do and what photography cannot do?
So now
you no longer have to paint portraits. There's nobody asking you to paint a portrait anymore. So what does that free you up to do?
Whoa. That's deep. That's an ego buster. That's an ego buster.
This is not what I signed up for. This is not theater.
Well, it is now.
Yeah, exactly. So now that it doesn't make sense to do plays that happen around a couch with a family having little family squabbles, what are you free to do? What are you free to explore?
Whoa, that's cool. Oh, I love that. My brain is going, yes! Oh, yeah.
So that's been the biggest learning thing, I think, for me during this process.
I think mine is, and this is an advice for, because our company started because we needed to make something in Singapore. We were dying. We needed to make something. And, you know, there's some things that we didn't do that I think that we could have really taken advantage of earlier on in the process when we started incorporating other artists, you know, outside of our friends and ourselves. And I think a production, a company manager, Sarah Caputo.
Amen.
We love you.
Amen to that.
Yeah, a company manager. Yeah, because it allows the creatives to be in that creative space, and the person creative. That's taking on, you know, the company manager will do that. You know, Sarah as an artist understands how, you know, crazy, you know, artists are and emotional and how things and how we think. And she's been incredible, you know, which is a huge gift to have as a part of the company. And I wish she were involved sooner, but you know, everything happens in its time. And I think also she's in a place where she knows how badass she is. So she can really hold space as well. So I think that's my biggest one, because as artists, we get so excited of wanting to put things up, but it's really important to have at least one person that can help keep you in line for managing whatever needs to happen so that you can stay in those spaces that are quite nonlinear.
She came along. Thank you for, I know I put the call out there on the podcast, but you answered it almost immediately because you heard me screaming for it. And thank goodness it came,
no, it's
it
like,
came along.
Damn, he's using the podcast to find it. Oh, shit. My boy's in trouble.
Wow. Adam's just begging on the podcast. He's just throwing it out there to anybody that's listening.
Talk about vulnerability.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure. You only need to ask, and you can ask however you want. So, what are we talking about today?
Well, we're back in the director's land, and we're talking about aesthetic. We're talking about style. The director's aesthetic, the director's taste. Yeah.
That's a big one.
Yeah, it could be.
Well, the first thing that comes up for me is that's a director's bread and butter, oftentimes.
Yeah. It can be. It also can be. There are directors out there that are known for their style, and there are directors out there that you could never know their names at all and see several of their plays. And
And I don't mean that as a bad thing. I don't necessarily mean that as a bad thing. I mean, it is a job, leading a room and getting people to go in a direction together, but you feel nothing, of the director's voice in the space at all. It's a very, and I don't mean this as a derogatory thing, but you can be a serviceable director. You can just job. You can just, stage actors and work together with designers and do all that. And again, absolutely no offense meaning by this, a lot of regional theater is that way because it's not about, it's not about a director's voice. It's about the play or the actors or the season that's being created. And that's fine. That's great. And then there are directors out there who you're going to see what you're going to see because you like the taste. You like that aesthetic. You like that style. And there you're going for that director more first and foremost.
Well, I think you're just already giving us a few things that we can chat about. So let's take a break. And I've got some questions for you about what you just said when we're talking about this world of aesthetic and style. And I think the first thing is we need to hear some definitions. What is your definition of aesthetic and what is your definition of style? So we can kind of see how you're navigating around these concepts. Yeah.
Okay.
I think we need a break for that one. So I think it's time for Purple Planet. Keyword planet. Take it away, Purple Planet. Purple Planet. So, look, Adam.
Yeah.
Let's cut to the chase. These words get thrown around all the time. And I'm sure there's some guests, listeners. I actually feel like they're in the room with us.
Exactly.
Totally. They're in the room with us. It's like, because I literally felt that gesture of like, I'm going to turn. And like, can we just open this up to the room, to the guests? And it's our listeners that are in the room with us.
Like we're doing the critical response process. And we're saying, okay, and now, do you have questions for the artist?
That's what it felt like. So can you just kind of give us an idea about, and I'm not asking you to be Webster's or Oxford, but... We need to know what these words mean to you.
Yeah. And you said don't be Webster's, but I did do a quick, etymological kind of origin because I wanted to make sure that what I thought was not just me thinking this thing, but it is the way of doing it. So we're talking aesthetic. We're talking about a kind of a underlying principles or underlying rules, underlying way of seeing a world, and the style being the tools that you use to make those underlying principles known, right? I may have an aesthetic, but if I don't have style, you're never going to know what my aesthetic is. I can talk about it, but I can't show it to you if I don't have style, if I don't have the tools to put it out there. When you're talking about aesthetic, you're talking about...
Can you just repeat that again? Because I love that. That's hitting me in all the right places, Daddy. Come on.
All right.
Say it again.
So the aesthetic, they're like principles. They're things that are underlying the work. They're laws. They're fundamental rules or laws that you have created for yourself. And I say that because, yes, there are... things in the world that are aesthetics, a sunrise or a sunset, those are aesthetically beautiful wherever you are in the world. Those are some things, but there are things where you get to create your own sense of aesthetics. What is beautiful to you, the artist? So the artist that is creating
your taste,
your taste, what you love, what gets you up and goes, that, you know, that makes me just shine inside. So what are the rules?
Lip smacking good.
Yeah. What are the rules and laws that you follow of what you find beautiful, of what you find correct and right in the world? And then style is the implementation of that. It's the particular way of doing something or saying something. It's what you uniquely use to express your aesthetic.
Mm. So good. It was even better the second time. Oh, Lord, that was good. Come on now. Come on.
Okay.
All right. So now we're talking about the director with aesthetic and style. And you said just before we went into the break, you were talking about, well, there's some things that, you know, essentially that many directors don't have control over.
Yeah.
And you were the first thing you were talking about was the play that a director has to direct. You know, what did you mean by that? When the director doesn't have a control over the plays they have to direct, when we're talking about style and aesthetic and what that means for a director that has a particular style and aesthetic and they've been given a particular play.
Well, did the director choose the play, or was the play already chosen and then a director was chosen for that play? That's one thing. You know, that's going to upend your ideas of, do I bring my aesthetic to this or not? You know, I have directed things that I do not like, that I do not want to do. And so that job becomes a job that's a serviceable thing. So my aesthetic has to take a back seat. I don't get to, you know, unfurl my wings. I don't get to fly. Mm. But I can still do my job. I can still be a professional. And so the aesthetic becomes about serving the play and the actors and the company first and foremost. It becomes about given circumstances. It becomes about clarity of action. It becomes about all the things that the audience needs to understand the play as is. And if I can throw in a little bit of cool, a little bit of something in there that is near my aesthetic, then that's great. That's just gravy. That's just extra that I can do. But my number one job at the end of the day is to make sure that there is clarity to the play and to the actor's actions, and that everything makes sense, and everybody can be seen, everybody can be heard, and there is a world that is created.
Okay.
If I can go beyond that.
So what about, yeah, go beyond that, please.
So if I can go beyond that and let's say I have chosen the play, or I do love the play that has been chosen for me, then I can really live in it and expand it and push and try some things out. And in a way, you know, the play is written, but in a way I can look at it like I'm devising the play new. It's a fresh new play. Nobody's seen this play before. I get a new interpretation. I get a new way of looking at it. I get to look at it from my lens, and I get to share with the audience my view on that lens. Am I going to do Streetcar Named Desire as is? The company does not want me to play with Streetcar Named Desire. The audience wants to see Streetcar Named Desire just like they saw Streetcar Named Desire in the movie. Okay, I don't get to express my aesthetic. But I get to work with actors. I get to work with a great play. I still have an enjoyable experience. But if the company is interested in a fresh new take on Streetcar Named Desire and is interested in, say, you know, Tennessee Williams always saw himself as Blanche DuBois, what if we were to recast this role as a gay man or a trans woman? What if we were to rethink these gender roles?
I want to see that play.
Right. What if we get to rethink these roles? What if it's not New Orleans 1945, but what if it's New Orleans right now, or post-Katrina New Orleans? How different would that world be?
Come on now.
And so then I get to go, okay, my aesthetic is interested in exploring these topics of gender and these topics of representation and these topics of, you know, whatever. And so I get to explore those things.
I've always wanted to do a Siegel with what's his name? Trepimov?
Trepliev. The writer?
Trepliev, yeah. Trepimov is, that's Terry Archer. Trepliev.
Yeah.
The writer. Wait, who's the writer? What's the writer's name?
Trepliev.
Trepliev. Okay. There we go. Dyslexia. Here we go. I've always wanted to do that as either a male identifying trans boy or like a lesbian girl, but always there's something in there in that relationship that is so appropriate for how the mother treats him. How the mother how Constantine gets, thank Constantine.
Yeah.
That feels so much better calling him exactly. Constantine. They have so many damn names. These fucking Russians. I love you Russians, but damn, can we just get one name? Yeah. Shit.
Kostya, Constantine, Trepliev.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I go, my brain, Constantine, Kostya. But like, I would love to see a trans boy play that role, a lesbian girl play that role, and keep Nina a female. I think it would play so beautifully. And wouldn't be a big leap for anybody going, oh, well, you know, here we go. Here's that inclusive casting. No, actually, these people do exist and did exist back then.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what the normal. I think that's the thing that we can also look at is how our aesthetic values can normalize something that may be otherized.
Mm. I there's a story about Hal Prince, amazing producer and director Hal Prince. You know, the producer mm-hmm. of like every single Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, the director of Phantom of the Opera and Assassins and. Almost every single Sondheim musical as well. Great, great, great director and producer. That he does this thing the day after one of his shows opens. He immediately has planned, scheduled in his calendar, a meeting to start work on his next project as soon as the show opens. So here Damn. We are, folks. Here we are, folks. Our show closes tonight. I'm announcing right now our next show is going to be Siegel. Because Booty put it out there, we're going to do Siegel. How about that?
I know some trans boys that can really do the part.
There you go.
Okay, so, all right. Now, I would love to talk about... Because I think this is really great. I'm so good at segues.
You're fantastic at segues
for this one.
Thank God you're around.
aesthetic traps. Can you talk about aesthetic traps?
Yeah. Well, early on as a director, aesthetic traps are your mentors. And, you know, imitation is the highest form of flattery, but... I fell into these aesthetic traps as well of not following my aesthetic, but of following somebody that I like's aesthetic and just mimicking the style on stage. And and as I said before, there was no there. There was the outer trappings of an aesthetic. There was a mask of an aesthetic, but there was nothing underneath it because I didn't know where it was coming from. I just liked it was pretty. I put it on stage. Huh. You know, I would steal from Romeo Castellucci or Peter Brook or, you know, Julie Taymor.
The greats.
The greats, of course.
We always steal from the greats.
Every director does. Every artist does. Every artist steals. And, you know, as Picasso said, there is nothing original. Every artist steals. The art of, I really truly believe the art of the director is hiding where you have stolen it from and combining so many things that nobody can actually tell. That you have stolen every single thing that is on the stage, and and the aesthetic
being
trap,
a good thief, y'all being a yeah, good thief,
be a fantastic thief. The aesthetic trap is putting the mask on stage without the soul underneath it. Putting the thing on stage without understanding where that thing came from. So that would be the first trap.
Would you say that dramaturgy would also help feed the aesthetic choices and help you not fall into that trap?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you're a good dramaturg yourself, or if you've got a dramaturg who's there and is can challenge you, then yes, you know, they'll ask that question. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the director is going to do what the director is going to do. If the director doesn't want to listen to the dramaturg, and I'm saying this because I did this. I didn't listen to my dramaturgs when they said, "Why are you doing that?" And I go, "Because you know, this moment represents that. But why did you choose that image? That's a very particular image to do that." Well, I think it's like that. And of course, I can bullshit anything. So I was bullshitting, you know, stealing something from Romeo Castellucci and putting it on stage in this play that has no context for where that original image came from.
You just liked it.
I just liked it. I thought it was cool. I thought it was effective. Yeah. Other aesthetic traps? Again, I think all aesthetic traps, no matter what they are going to be anything that gets away from what your aesthetic is. If you're not connected with your aesthetic, if you're not leading from your aesthetic, but you're leading from what you think the audience is going to like, or you are doing something because it's going to please somebody else, a designer, or you know, an actor, or the company, the production manager, whatever, leading anything that is not attached to your aesthetic is going to be an aesthetic trap. Because either you're going to sabotage it, or you're going to go down the path of not understanding what it truly is and just go for the outward kind of show, the flair of it.
Well, and that's a beautiful segue into my next question, which I think I'll ask you after the break. But I want you to kind of ponder this over the break, and I'm just want to look at style choices. Style choices of the director and styles of plays and how they can work together and work against each other. So looking at style choices.
Okay.
How's that sound?
Okay. Okay.
Sure. I'm going to give you the break to think about it.
Okay. I don't know where we're going with this.
Take it away, Purple Planet. Take it away, Purple Planet. I've got Adam under the hot lights right now, asking him about style choices. I think we should also go back into your definition of style so people can kind of remember what we're talking about again.
Yeah. So aesthetic being the kind of the rules, the foundation, the principles that you as the artist follow and like, you know, the rules of the universe. Gravity exists. They're up is up and down is down, and those are the way that the rules of this universe work as an artist. These are the things that I follow. The style are the things that you use to express your aesthetic. They're the way that you use space, use time, use color, use techniques and tools, the way you talk about it. That's all style. So if the aesthetic is the soul, if I'm going to use this analogy again, if the aesthetic is the soul, the style is the mask. It's the outward show of that thing.
Oh, that's such a... it's even better the third time. I love your definition of aesthetic and style. I have behavior all over the place. Wonderful. So look... Let's talk about some, I know, it's just tantalizing. It's titillating. Style, Adam.
Yeah.
Style. So what are some of the popular theatrical styles that are the common theatrical styles that everyone's, oh, that's this style. Oh, that's that style.
Okay. All right. Musical theater. as a broad genre, as a style. And I hesitate to say that because we know, everybody knows that each musical is different. But when you say musical theater, everybody is thinking a couple of things. Flashy costumes, lots of big dancing, smiling, and jazz hands, and all those things. And like, yeah, that's crazy for you, but that's not Hamilton. But those are both musicals. You know, that may be Kiss Me, Kate, but it's not Spring Awakening. But those are both musicals. But the musical style is usually what everybody is going to school to study. Those big, flashy 1940s, 50s, and 60s musicals, which dominate so much of those things, that's a style. Mm. But then there's also the 60s and 70s musicals, which is a Fosse musical, and that's a different style. And then you get into the rock musicals, and that's a different style. So those are styles. Those are the trappings of those things. A Neil Simon comedy.
So in those examples, okay, so I'm going to go back to Neil Simon in a second because I was just thinking of like Hamilton versus On the Town.
Okay, yeah.
So can you talk us through the difference between style and aesthetic between those two plays?
They're coming from a very different place. The writers, the writers, the creators of the show had a very specific aesthetic that unless you are an adventurous director that has the okay from the estate to do that, you can't be adventurous with that play anymore. Let's go with Oklahoma. Very good example because of the recent production. Okay. Oklahoma, old, creaky, dusty play that everybody has done in high school or somewhere, you know, some community college or some, you know, amateur theater somewhere. Everybody has seen, knows Oklahoma. It is what it is, right? My grandmother performed in Oklahoma on Broadway. That's how very old this musical is. And it's old. It's old and it's creaky and it's dusty. Yeah, there's a reason that high schools do it because it's safe.
Yeah. My very first musical role was Judd Fry in Oklahoma.
Oh God.
It was double cast and, with a girl. And she was tone deaf.
The floor squeaks. The mouse creaks.
The door creaks. Mouse about to the living of the world. I said, oh, Lord. And then, of course, me being the drama queen that I was like, she's so horrible. I can't believe I have to share the stage with her. Anyway, so continue.
The Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, when they created it, they had an aesthetic. They had their own aesthetic. And now I am not at all downplaying what they have done. You know, you look at South Pacific and you look at how they are treating race in South Pacific in the 1950s. That was radical in the 1950s. But South Pacific today, it's not radical. It's actually a little racist. You know, as it was trying to be anti-racist in the 50s. For then, it was anti-racist. Now it's racist. And it's very similar to everything else that they have written as well. They were radical for their time, and then now they're not. So why are we still doing that? So this is the thing.
Good question.
Can you get to what their aesthetic soul was? And then, as we've talked about before, as a director, can you bridge the play to the current audience? And so The current production, I don't know if it's not current anymore, but the most recent production of Oklahoma that was on Broadway started at St. Anne's Warehouse and was brought to Broadway and won numerous awards, got back to that because it modernized it. It didn't change any language. It didn't change the words or the music or anything else, but it put it in a context of, okay, let's do a play about Oklahoma in 2018. Oklahoma is a very different place in 2018. Oklahoma is the dream of Oklahoma doesn't quite exist anymore. So what does it mean to have these things? What does it mean to have somebody who is creeping on these women today? And what does it mean when he is rejected today? Those are very interesting things.
Did they have Did they have cell phones and like do hashtags Me Too?
No. So, I mean, it's one of those things where like, is it 2018 or is it not 2018? But it's very clearly a modern understanding because, you know, Ayo Annie is in a wheelchair. You know, there are people of color in the cast, which it's never been before in Oklahoma and, you know, 19th century Oklahoma. There are no people of color. There's no understanding of people of color. There was no Me Too in Oklahoma back then, but there's very clearly an understanding, at least in the audience.
Oh my God, Ayo Annie as a paraplegic. That's intense.
Yeah.
That song, I'm Just a Girl Who Can't Say No.
Exactly.
Whoa.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
And so that kind of understanding of doing that, of understanding what the original aesthetic was, and then creating it for a modern audience, and then adding the style. The style is just telling you, this is 2018, Me Too exists, there are people of color, there are people who are differently abled than us, and the style expresses all those things to get to the aesthetic. But again, it's the director's aesthetic matched with the original aesthetic of the creators so that it doesn't clash. It doesn't go away.
In the style of musical theater.
In the style of musical theater. It's still musical theater, but it's not a 1950s style of musical theater. It's very clearly 2018, 2019, 2020 musical theater, which is Hamilton and Spring Awakening and these, you know, nobody's, if you're doing Crazy for You, you're probably doing it at a university somewhere and your teachers are telling you, this is going to be good. You're going to, you know, this is good to learn these things. But it doesn't quite make sense.
Well, that's interesting because now we're going, that's interesting because if we're going to musical theater style, you said Noel Coward is another style, but that's also a playwright.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that?
Yeah. You know, so many, I kind of think that playwrights lead the shifts in theater. I think that they are the ones that are bringing about, you know, theater is the last, is the art form that is always the last to adopt whatever is happening around the world. I don't know why that happens to be.
Interesting.
But it always is. It's the one that, it, you know, we were the last ones to become absurdist. You know, the painters were doing it, you know, 40, 50 years before we in the theater were doing absurdist theater. Experimental things, you know, happening things, they were happening in the art world long before we in the theater started doing it. And so playwrights are the ones that kind of see that shift and start writing plays for that. So, you know, let's take the existentialist, absurdist. Let's take Beckett, you know. There was no real existentialism in the theater as a style until Beckett wrote existentialism into the theater. And then you had to have a style to do his plays. You couldn't direct his plays like Boulevard comedy. You can't. It just won't hold up. It won't make any sense.
Oh my God! Waiting for Godot as a Boulevard comedy,
right?
That'd be so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. You know.
Oh God, it's painful.
Let's do Waiting for Godot as if it was Noel Coward. You know, let's keep it short and sharp and quick. And yeah, you know, everybody's got a tuxedo on and we're in a beautiful hotel. Everything's fantastic.
Oh, my God. That gives me a headache just thinking about it. What are some other common styles?
Let's see. Again, I'm probably thinking of playwrights because playwrights are the ones that are leading this movement. So, the in your face, the John Osborne look back in anger. Right. That's you know, Pinter was a little bit a part of that. So was Edward Bond. The kind of grungy, dark 60s and 70s Britain kind of style of writing.
Sarah Kane
is coming out of that. In America, I think the ones that Galtney loves so much, Sam Shepard, you know, that's, you know, those are styles. And, you know, for, you know, you look at those decades, you look at those periods in theater and those plays all kind of look alike. Because everybody is doing that style. And then a new playwright comes along, yeah. and you've got Tony Kushner, and then you've got magical realism back in the theater, and everybody's interested in doing magical realism. Or yeah. Anna Deavers-Smith, yeah. and yeah. she's doing docudrama kind of things, and then everybody wants to do docudrama kind of things.
Anna Deavers-Smith, that's my girl.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, yes.
And
yes,
then, you know, now you got Jackie Sibley's Drury, or Jeremy O'Harris, you know, Fairview or Slave Play, and now...
Yes.
Now we're writing things and we're delving into topics in this kind of like what is real, what is not real land that we're living in, where yeah. fake news is yeah. a thing, and we're dealing with race on a daily basis in the United States and other places. So
yeah.
style is ever changing, and we all kind of gravitate toward a style for a while until that becomes passé, and then mm-hmm. we're afraid to make the jump. Because I've defined myself with this certain style for so long. My style, mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of like, say, who's a director that's so defined by their style, by playwright that only works with these certain playwrights, and they've, you know, like, Hal Prince, again, Harold Prince, who is so defined by Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals,
mm-hmm.
Would you trust him? Would you go see him do a very dark, dramatic play by, I can't even think of anybody to put in that would be ridiculous. Like I was saying, it would be ridiculous to say, you know, a Jeremy O'Harris play that Hal Prince is going to direct and produce.
Well, you also have Lloyd Richards and August Wilson.
Yeah, okay. Hal Prince doing a Jeremy O'Harris play, or Lloyd Richards. You know, Lloyd Richards is defined so much by, not totally defined by, but he's very much defined by his work with August Wilson. He is known for...
Well, he brought African-American theater to the contemporary stage.
Yeah.
He's the godfather of contemporary 20th century theater.
Would you, not to knock him at all, would you trust him, would you be interested to see, other than maybe out of curiosity, him do Neil Simon's latest play?
Yeah, I would.
Right, but you're...
I think,
out of curiosity.
I think, yeah. I think it'd be. I'd like to see him direct. Let me see. What would I like to see him direct? SpongeBob.
Right. Yeah. That's even more of an extreme. You're right. You're absolutely right.
Because he's a humanist, so he's really good at getting these relationships. But if we go in that SpongeBob-y musical theater viewpointy world, I think that would be a challenge for
right. It's
my great teacher.
It's one of those things where you're like, he's doing what? She's doing what? You know, when I heard that Tina Landau was directing SpongeBob, I was like, she's doing what? She's gonna huh? She's doing what? But then, you know,
and she did a good job.
She did a good job. It's SpongeBob is a musical, but you know, whatever.
Yeah, it doesn't match your aesthetic.
Yeah, yeah.
But she did a great job.
Yeah,
it was funny because there's actually, in that particular musical, there's a duet between SpongeBob and the starfish, his best friend,
Patrick.
And it's a song about best friends, about how they miss each other, yeah. about how SpongeBob and Patrick. I was weeping. It was so beautiful. It was so beautiful. It was the lyrics and the singing and the moment was so beautiful. It flipped me into like some, and I guess my clown brain really just loved it, because being in this, you know, this big flashy world of SpongeBob imagination, and then to have this beautiful heartfelt duet, you know, and that's where I think aesthetic and style can really push through to an audience, because Tina Landau has a very strong aesthetic.
She does. She absolutely does. I just remembered what I was going to say of which director and which playwright, because I actually asked this question. Romeo Castellucci and Grease. I actually asked...
It would be dark. It would be dark.
I actually asked this question of him sometime. You know, I asked him, do you watch theater? Do you watch other theater out there? And he said, yeah, of course. Whenever I'm at a festival, I see the other things. I was like, yeah, but I mean, like, if you were with your kids or whatever, and you were going to go see theater, like, would you go see a Grease? And he actually said, I actually enjoy Grease. Okay. All right. Sure. I want to see Romeo Castellucci.
Summer
do a little shop
days of drifting away to other summer nights. Oh, well, oh, well, oh, well, oh, huh. And then a car drops down and a horse explodes from the inside of it.
Exactly.
and then the whole stage fills with blood. And then they go, tell me more. How much dough did he spend?
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me more. And then someone has a gun and shoots someone in the head, and their head explodes and the blood splashes on the screen behind them. And then there's a lady screaming and dancing who's nude. And then she says, does he have a friend?
See?
Na, 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 na.
What you just did was you just did style. You know Romeo Castellucci's style so much.
Yeah.
You know exactly. Exactly.
And then I go to walk across the stage, and then there'd be like some intelligible mumbling, and then like flashes of different symbols, and then
but all of it would have a meaning, because his aesthetic principle is very, very sound, dramaturgically sound. He would have a definition for every single thing that he was doing. You would know that it meant something, but you wouldn't know what it meant. Exactly. That's his style.
Okay, so now we're doing it. So Ivo van Hove. Let's talk about style and aesthetic and what he does.
It's almost like, I could check off a list of everything that he does. I mean, that's the thing. It's like when we're talking about a director's style, we're saying like, what is it that always makes it into that person's show? Okay. So Ivo van Hove is going to be a office aesthetic. His partner, Jan van der Wiel, who designs everything for him, makes the setting look like it's in an office. Like the furniture is from IKEA, it's in some, you know, middle management company somewhere. That is where it's always going to be that. The exception being, his look at
View
from the Bridge and Crucible. But everything else that he does is always that kind of office aesthetic. Network was the exact same way, and all of his other plays are that way. Okay, the other thing he's going to
Kings of War was like that as well.
Kings of War, exactly. His Angels in America is that way.
His Misanthrope,
his Teorama, his, you know, all those things. They all are that same very kind of aesthetic. It is going to be modernized. He's never going to do it in a period thing. There are going to be cameras on stage. There are going to be camera operators always seen on stage. The audience is going to be either already sitting on stage or they're going to be invited to come onto stage. There is usually an extreme form of violence as communication. There's usually a recognition of a ticking clock. So time is live, and it is. So the death of Cleopatra is announced. There's a clock that is ticking down when he is doing the Roman plays. Network. His production network, there are clocks everywhere. There's a sense of real time on the stage. Those are things that are like, if I were to be transported into a play and I saw three of those things, I go, oh, this is probably an Ivo van Hove play. That's his style.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay, let's look at Robert Wilson.
His lights, clearly. The horizontal line on the back of the wall that goes up. He invented this thing, so he's going to use it a lot. His extreme use of color, oversaturation of color. He's usually painting the faces white of his actors, especially when that started happening when he was working with Berliner Ensemble, because that's what they've always done as well. So that's a style that he's adapted from another person's style, Berliner Ensemble style, which is a Brechtian style. Language, huge important part of his work. Language, the lack of language or the oversaturation of language or gibberish.
Mm-hmm.
Music. He's also mm-hmm. he's also collaborating. He's usually not doing anything alone necessarily anymore. He doesn't tend to do alone stuff anymore. He tends to collaborate with other big artists now.
Gesture.
Yeah. The codified movement. Those are all things ticking off the box of, yep, that's that artist right there. That's the style that they use because it's just defined by his aesthetic. His story.
And tempo rhythm.
Yeah.
He's so good at pauses. He's so good at when the pause happens and then when something else comes in and like really guiding. And changing time. He's one of the best at changing time.
And empty space. And not being afraid of having a lot of empty space. He doesn't clutter the stage. Whereas Ivo van Hove clutters the stage, his stage is sparse. It is
pristine.
It's austere in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pristine.
Yeah.
So clean. Yeah. So clean. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Even in Makassar.
Yeah. Even in Indonesia, he made it so clean.
So look, I think that's a really, I think we're kind of moving into provocations world. Yeah. So think about the provocations you would like to give our listeners. And we'll go on a break. Yeah? Mm. And come back and come back with some provocations.
Yeah.
Sound good?
Sound good.
All right. Take it away, Purple Planet. It's time for provocations. Provocations. Okay. This is your bag. Adam Marple. Provocations.
It's not anything radical. I mean, I'm just going to ask the audience to... I'm going to ask the audience to think about what their aesthetic is. A lot of times we don't actually cognitively, consciously understand what our aesthetic is. We know what we like. But have we ever taken the time to consciously recognize what we like and why we like it? There are things that always end up in that end up in my shows. There are things that just end up in my shows, and it's almost kind of a joke amongst the actors that I've worked with that know me, because they know, like, everybody come to rehearsal, take your shoes off. We're not going to be performing in shoes, so what's the point of having shoes on? The feet are important. And it's, you know, that's the style is that. But what they don't understand is the aesthetic of the feet don't lie. You know, an actor could be up there emoting and acting and everything else like that. But if I see those toes moving and I see the scrunchy toes
fumbling,
then I know that they're not connected. I can see that they're not grounded, you know. So it was an aesthetic thing first that became a style thing. So I'm just going to ask you to review what it is that you love. What it is that gets you going? What is it that fills you enthusiasm? This was the word. Remember when I told you the etymological origin of enthusiasm?
Yes. Can you tell them again?
Enthusiasm etymologically means enthusos, which is God through me. So whenever you're enthusiastic, whenever you become enthused, it's as if God is entering through you. And so what is it that makes you enthusiastic about a work, about your own work specifically? Not other people's work. You can like other people's work, but what is it about your own work that when you're doing something constantly keeps coming up? Because otherwise it's just habit, right? And we don't we can't use habit if we don't know why we're doing it. We can't change habit or use it if we don't know what we're doing. So what are your aesthetic habits? Just list those things down, and then once you know them, you can start playing with them.
Well, I'm going to tag on to that one. I think that's great because I'm going to tag on to that one. I want you to look at style, and we'll start with like, you know, the rudimentary of like when we talk about style, how you dress, How does your personal style, you know, and often people say, I don't have a style. Okay, so if you're saying you don't have a style, then you clearly have an aesthetic mm-hmm. that counters what you consider to be style mm-hmm. as not being as what you are, right? So I want you to look at your own personal fashion as your style to help you understand your aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then branch that out into other realms, styles of theater, styles of film, styles of writing. And, you know, it's very easy to find styles, lists of different styles on the internet. That's the easy part. Yeah. But the part that I want you to see is how your aesthetic can meet those styles and how your aesthetic goes against those styles. Yeah, because mm-hmm. as you said, Adam, it's everyone gets scared initially about, oh, I don't know what my aesthetic is. I don't know what aesthetic is because it's we feel it. Because mm-hmm. so much of aesthetic is about a feeling.
Yeah,
you know, it's about a feeling. It's about taste. It's about something that's creating behavior in you. You don't know why you like it, but you like it. You know, and having to figure out why you like something can take a bit of time.
Yeah.
So that's my provocation. And look, we have been performing, and I think there might even be a ticket available.
If you're listening to this today, Monday, January 18th, we still have one more performance this evening, this afternoon, depending on where you are in the world. If you're East Coast, it is 5 p.m. East Coast. If you are in Australia, what time is it? I'm going to double check it. So it's 5 p.m. East Coast.
Double check it.
It is 11 p.m. London. It is 10 a.m. Melbourne. So that is 9 a.m. Singapore. So if you are hearing this and you could possibly want to see this show that we've been talking about for so long, we still have tickets available. You can still come in and see the show today and see it that way. So we'd love to have you there. You can get the tickets on our website, theaterofothers.com. You can find it in our Instagram page, our Facebook page, all those places, even in the show notes of the podcast that you're listening to right now. All that information is there. Once we are done with the show,
if you can't make it, just make sure you subscribe, subscribe.
That's right. Always subscribe. And you know, if you want to send a message back to us about provocations, or you want to send a question to us, you can do that to speakpipe.com/theaterofothers. Speakpipe.com/theaterofothers. You can leave a 90-second voice message. If you want to leave an email to us, it's podcast@theaterofothers.com. Again, you can send it to our Instagram page or our Facebook page. We can take messages from there. And don't just subscribe. Tell a friend. We want to grow the audience. So if this has been any benefit to you over the last half year, share it with somebody. Share and help us grow. Help us to meet new people. We'd love to have new voices.
Yeah, and hello, if you're one of our students and you know other students, you know, if you're one of our students and you know other students that love us and don't know about the podcast, let them know. Get them in the room.
Exactly.
And if you're not one of our students, let people know. Get them in the room. It's a movement, y'all. And we're just so happy to have a space that we can share these so, so brilliant words with you. We know what we talk about, y'all. We know what we talk about.
We're brilliant.
Oh, my God. We're so brilliant. I think on that note, we should probably leave before we dig another hole for ourselves. Probably. It's so good to see you, Adam.
To see you.
Thank you for directing the play.
We're gonna finish it up strong. It's gonna be amazing.
Yeah. And for all of y'all listeners, we'll see you soon. Bye.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Theater Brothers podcast. Make sure to visit our website, theaterofothers.org, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or via RSS, so you'll never miss a show. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. A special thank you to Purple Planet for the music you've heard. The Theater of Others creates a shared community of artists and audiences for the purposes of exploring the most profound issues of our lives and times. We believe the play watches the audience. The audience is necessary, and they are witness to what happens. And you get to be witness to us making that happen. The purpose of this podcast is to open up our process and let you in. We're peeling back the curtain, so to speak, and encouraging you to follow along, to ponder, prod, and question, to join us and criticize us if need be. Being a witness is no passive task and requires much from you. Are you up for the journey? Be sure to tune in next week for our next journey.